This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Savage Wars, written by Jason Ansbach and Nick Cole, performed by Stephen Lang.
Prologue. The state of play in those heady days before the rise of the Legion and the beginning of a galactic-wide republic that would last nearly 1,500 years was simply fantastic. Citizens of the present age paint that time as a sort of dark ages that had fallen over the early galactic nations. But in truth, it was a time of fantastic wonders. The fragile human explorer colonies that had first leapt outward to the advent of the hyperdrive had blossomed into incredible civilizations and even fledgling empires, all connected by the gossamer of faster-than-light travel. The age of hyperspace civilization had begun. Espana ruled over a clutch of dazzling worlds along the Siriusan frontier. From Spilurza came the galaxy's finest technologists, bringing with them their haunting leaps into the world of theoretical dark science. And the Vesper Confederacy, the Rigel Assembly, Britannia, and the old United Worlds were the power players as man first began to unite into the tribes that would form the mighty galaxy-spanning republic. But these fragile stellar homes, expanding outward toward the ever-widening frontier, were not without their monsters. And sometimes, the worst monsters are ourselves. Our savage selves. All throughout the centuries that passed, since the advent of faster-than-light travel, the savages' massive sublight colony ships, ships that had left a dying Earth during its darkest hours, had flung themselves outward. Only recently had they begun to heave into the frailer systems along the frontier, systems already inhabited by their human brethren who'd left Earth later but reached the stars much earlier, thanks to the hyperdrive. These encounters, though rare, were neither merry nor happy. They were outright nightmares. Because the savages, in their ages-long crawl through the intergalactic dark, marinating in their dystopian science experiments, had slowly but surely began shedding their humanity. They were now something much different. Though they were called savages, and the term stuck and entered the popular lexicon, they viewed themselves as far superior to their unevolved brethren. And in some cases, especially with regard to technology and weaponry, they were. Fortunately for the human colonists, the savages' feeling of superiority extended to the other savages, those who had left Earth in different lighthuggers. Each ship had its own portrait of the divine, of perfection, surpassing all others, and each saw all other savage visions as blasphemous, and thus all other savage tribes as blasphemers, enemies, targets. Thus, those early savage attacks were isolated incidents performed by isolated ships, and the frontier colonies were able to use their technology to amass boarding parties and naval resistance, driving the larger lighthuggers away and sending the smaller ones burning helplessly into the atmosphere. The fights were costly but localized and winnable. The sluggish lighthuggers were easy to detect and easy to defend against, until the savages acquired one key piece of technology, hyperdrive. And with that, the savages found themselves able to assemble, to put aside the rancor they had for one another and focus on the real threat to their survival, us, to prepare for war greater than the galaxy had ever seen, at least since the days of the ancients. The savages were set to assume their place as rulers of the galaxy, forgotten kings and lords returned. Their ascension would begin at New Vega, the brightest of the new colonies of forgotten Earth's children. It was there that the savages would come in from the cold interstellar distances. It was time. For the next 1,500 years, there would be war between the savages and the rest of the galaxy. A war for mastery, a war for domination, a war that could end only in total victory for one side or the other. There was no other solution. The savages were gods, and all others owed them worship. In that first fiery crucible that would become the Battle of New Vega, human men and women, along with the dozen alien races known at that time, answered the call. But death walked among them. Starships clashed, the sky caught fire, and cities burned to molten steel and ash. Great destructive powers were unleashed. Nightmares were made all too real. That horrific battle was a mere taste of what was to come in the long years ahead. A taste and a dire warning. And hither came Tyrus Rex. Part 1. Chapter 1. 25th Spallerzan Light. Attached to Coalition Strike Force Warhammer. Tactical Assault Carrier, Montague. On approach to New Vega. Captain Garce had the helm as the flat, sturdy transport fell from hyperspace just beyond the planet's outer atmosphere. There were 5 assault carrier transports in this flight, and all had come out of hyper in formation, which was no easy feat. But the United Worlds, or UW, pronounced UW by busy spacers and soldiers, had the best trained navy in existence, and as long as they were working with themselves and not the other unprofessional navies of the Coalition, they could be relied on to execute advanced fleet maneuvers. It was always the combined ops with other navies where things got a little sketchy. "Radar," said Goss, setting the deflectors to full forward. They were picking up a lot of chop from the outer atmosphere. The entire ship, 15 decks and 400 meters long, was bouncing and tossing as they set up to thread atmospheric reentry. "Get me a ping on Indomitable." He turned and smiled at Colonel Marks, the commander of his passengers. "We're having fun now." Marks made an effort to smile back, but the man was so enigmatically unknowable, it was hard to say whether he was having fun or just letting Goss know that he was aware that he was having fun. And Goss was just fine with that. He had grown to like the colonel a lot in the flight out. They'd often played chess in the officers' mess in the late shiptime evenings. Marks was an exceptionally quiet man, not much for conversation. Goss was fine with that, too. The captain liked doing the talking, and Marks was a perfect complement, content to sit and listen, and beat him at the game soundly every night. Goss marveled at that. Colonel Marks wasn't a brilliant player. He lacked the flash and the imagination of someone who saw all the corners of the board and laid elaborate traps, but he was relentless, and he had the ability to see ahead. Goss had once asked just how many moves ahead Marks could see, but the man wasn't able to articulate much.
"I just run my game and have a pretty good idea of what people are going to do at any given moment."
That was about the most conversation Goss had gotten out of him at any one time during the jump.
"Indom's coming through and on our 6, said Radar. "But she has no escorts. Didn't make the jump on time."
"Damn," muttered Goss. He dialed in the approach. They were at 120 Angels and coming in fast. Their atmospheric carrier was supposed to be overwatched by Rigelian free trader corvettes. But as always, inter-Navy ops were proving difficult. "Get me, Admiral." The shaking began to subside as they entered a new atmospheric layer. But a new problem barged its way into command before Goss could finish his sentence.
"Sir, we got contacts," said Radar. "Multiple bogeys coming in from all directions."
"At this altitude?" said the first officer from the co-pilot's chair.
The TAC officer chimed in over comm from back in the Montague's tiny combat information center.
"Maybe new vegan Air Force? Some sort of high-altitude fighter we don't know about."
"We better hope," said Goss. "Spin up the PDCs. I don't want to get caught with our pants down."
He switched over to private comm on his headset, selected Colonel Marks from the menu with a flick of thumb on the flight yoke, then turned once more to his chess opponent. No one else could hear over the ambient roar of the Montague's powerful engines and the violence of reentry.
"Colonel?"
Colonel Marks looked up from the battle board.
"Doesn't look good," Goss said.
"TAC support carrier came in alone. You better get your men ready. My guess is the LZ is going to be hot and we're not going to be holding over New Vega City. With no escort, she'll be coming in blind. She won't be able to deploy cover until we're below 10,000. That means no air support to take Rio."
"Thanks for the heads up."
Marks unbuckled from his jump seat and made his way aft and below to his unit down on the assault decks.
"Gonna be a long day," sighed Goss as he exchanged a look with his first officer.
"Got that right," was what the first officer was about to say, when the point defense cannons opened from the Montague's starboard side, all three at once. Their groan was the sound of thousands of 20-millimeter depleted uranium balls being flung along plotted intercept trajectories to engage the incoming bogies. The railgun system was expensive and antiquated, but it did the job better than any modern blaster cannon had ever been able to. Plus, Old Earth had the resource base to provide the high-velocity projectiles.
"Bandits," called out Goss, upgrading the unknown identifier of bogey to bandit, an adversary and not just a contact. 11 o'clock.
Matte gray tiger-striped twin-hulled fighters streaked from left to right in front of the descending tactical assault carrier group. The defense cannons managed to smoke three bandits, but two enemy fighters unloaded at almost suicidally close range, and the effects were instantly devastating to the flight crew of the Montague. These savage weapons were far more powerful than any blaster technology the crew had ever witnessed on starfighters. For a moment, Goss's mind refused to believe what was happening. He told himself it must just be particularly low-interval blaster fire. But the sudden swarm of dumb rounds that raked the forward bridge sounded just like the Montague's archaic but effective perimeter defense cannons, which, in a very advanced form, were also nothing more than what some had once called guns. The bridge was holed in a dozen places, and the entire flight deck turned into a Cat 5 hurricane as it depressurized. Any crew members who hadn't been strapped in were sucked out by rapid decompression into the high atmosphere. Goss turned to see his first officer, riding shotgun, have his head vaporized by a massive round. The captain could feel himself being sucked out and away, but the restraining harness built into the pilot's chair held fast. His flight helmet saved him too, when his head was violently thrown about and into the various systems too close at hand. But he was blacking out all the same. As he struggled to connect his oxygen, he monitored the instruments to check what attitude his ship was in. It hadn't healed over, that was good. But it continued to drop through the atmosphere of New Vega. Warning bells and damage klaxons whoop-whooped for his attention. Crew members were screaming or shouting orders. The radar intercept officer screamed over chat and was sucked out through a gaping hole in the fuselage seconds before pressure equalized. Goss felt an arctic blast of oxygen wash over his near-frozen face. He gulped it down deeply. Emergency bulkheads were slamming shut between the bridge and the CIC. Engine 4 failed. He was trying to fly the ship when he saw the Hernandez, another assault carrier in the group, go up in a sudden ball of fury off the port side. 1,240 people dead in a flash. "Not important," he screamed at himself as the wind shrieked in through the shattered hull. "Fly your own damn ship, you idiot." He could hear comm reports telling him the Indomitable was in trouble and requesting help. Engineering reported that number 4 had gone up like a firecracker and that there were mass casualties on the deck. But the ship was back under his control. He had power and maneuverability. It wasn't dead stick yet. And his job was to get the infantry down and secure a beachhead around Objective Rio. He took a calming breath and felt a sharp pain in his lungs. Looking down, he saw that his flight suit was dark and wet. He'd been shot in the gut. "Not important," he muttered through gritted teeth, and flew the approach to Objective Rio, dipping lower into the atmosphere. At 20,000, the savages opened up with air defense artillery at their beached whale of a ship. Chapter 2. Sergeant Major Andres hovered nearby as Colonel Marks pulled the unit's standard-issue ablative plate carrier over the gray digital camo fatigues the 25th Light wore for urban combat. Marks was early middle age, young to have already made the rank of colonel within the Spallerzan Army. Andres knew he'd been in Black Watch, Spallerza's special forces group, and assumed he must have been a highly motivated super trooper to have ranked so hard so fast, and that it was only because he was so high-speed, low-drag that he'd been placed in command at the last second after the last CO had taken suddenly ill. The sergeant major already had his commanding officer's load-carrying equipment ready when the man stood. The colonel slung himself into the LCE, grabbed his helmet from the locker, and tapped the comm interface to make sure he was connected to the command net. Then he took the unit-issue pulse sidearm, a snub-nosed Melodian Garrick with tactical grips and 15-shot charge pack, and holstered it. Andres handed him a troop-issue pulse rifle.
Sir,
he shouted, struggling to be heard over the damage control alarms. I know you Blackwatch types like to use all your high-speed toys and all, and I advise you to just carry what you're used to, since it seems like this is going to be lit as can be and everything. You don't have to carry the unit issue. Just as Marks opened his mouth to yell back, the alarms finally shut off and the ship, which had seemed out of control for a moment or two and was probably heavily damaged, was now once more steady and stable, indefinitely in some kind of descent profile. He guessed they had lost one of the engines up top.
No thanks, Sergeant Major, the colonel said. We all use the same gear.
Nothing more, nothing less. The sergeant major was still learning that the new colonel was all business. Marks never gave the impression that he was anything but, and with enemy flak coming in close to the hull and exploding, that didn't seem a bad thing. It looked like things were indeed going to get hot. Maybe not Kimshana Huli Valley hot, but hot enough. The colonel entered the briefing room to find his five company commanders studying their battle boards with their helmets tucked under their arms. All of them were young, high-speed infantry officers. There were no weak links. Marks had made sure of that. And so had Admiral Sulla, the United Worlds liaison who'd been the prime motivator behind the whole operation.
Gentlemen, began Marks.
The officers turned to face their commander. He'd ordered saluting dispensed with for the duration of the op, and none of them even twitched a muscle. Considering how military courtesy had been drilled into them by the professional Spillers and Army, one of the best in the coalition, Marks was impressed with their ability to quickly adapt. But he didn't let it show in the least on his stern face.
Things don't look good.
Marks's face didn't show concern over the fact.
Obviously, you're watching Fleet CIC. Three transports destroyed already. That leaves us with the 3-6 armored cav. We will hold Objective Rio until the fleet arrives in full. You have your sectors. If the situation changes on the ground, be ready to adapt. Join your companies in the MTACs, and be ready for anything. I'll remind you once again, every Savage ship is a different thing. Expect the unexpected, and you won't be surprised.
Yes, sir,
the men boomed in reply. As the captains departed to join their companies aboard the mobile tactical assault crawlers, Sergeant Major Andres led Marks to the headquarters MTAC, where he joined the HQ command team and plugged into Fleet CIC. Multiple images showed every Strike Force Warhammer asset in system. There were half as many as there were supposed to be, and most were coming in drips and dribbles. Task Force Wrath would arrive shortly, once the initial insertion LZ was secure. But many of the ships coming through in the first wave were getting shot up by what Fleet CIC was now tagging as Savage Interceptors. How they have ships the size of our fighters that are both space and atmosphere capable is a mystery to me, muttered the S2 officer, shaking his head over a battle board. Marks was more concerned with the approach to Objective Rio and the city that surrounded it. It was pre-dawn dark, 0324 local time. Much of the fantastic city was in complete blackout. The feed from the cockpit sensors wasn't good. Lots of disturbance.
Is that from us or local effect?
Someone asked regarding the quality of the feed.
Probably us, said the S2. Ship got hit pretty hard coming in, but the flies are holding her together on 3 engines.
Good for Navy,
someone noted dourly.
Then they all saw it.
Some gawped, others cursed. The Savage ship was massive, easily 10 kilometers long. It was just a shadowy shape down there on the surface, but that shape revealed a slender bow, a fat and stacked midships, angular decks carved and rotating cylindrically along rising planes, and massive sublight engines flaring away from the rear.
almost like an old-school rocket made high-tech if your perspective of such things was 500 years old. And somehow, it had managed to set down inside the city, like it wasn't going anywhere ever again.
Should just pave this place with nukes. That's what Rex would have done.
Yeah,
and then we'd be war criminals, too.
The Lighthugger was a thing as old as spaceflight itself. Something from the Earth of long ago. They'd called them colony ships back when the world was falling apart. Now the galaxy called them the Savage Hulks.
We did, noted some NCO.
Cut that, said Sergeant Major Andre sharply.
30 seconds, Colonel, said Goss over the comm. Good luck, and it was nice knowing you.
Then the captain coughed, and it didn't sound good. Marks could tell the captain of the Montague was wounded. That much was clear. But he was a hell of a pilot, and he would get them down and into the action, which was all any infantryman could ever ask for, a chance to show and fight without getting killed on the way. That, and to be shown where the enemy was, so that the shooting could start. After that, it was anybody's game.
You too, Mark said tersely, and then the comm was cut. 30 seconds, shouted the loadmaster over the assault bay speakers. Be advised.
A massive explosion somewhere along the hull sent the ship lurching violently, but it continued its approach to Objective Rio over the outer suburbs of New Vega City. They were almost there. The LZ was lit by the invisible neon green of the Pathfinder's marking lasers, but the rest of the city was shadowed in blues and grays.
Strap in, yelled the sergeant major. This is the big show.
Marks did a weapons check on the 25th's issue pulse rifle while he made his way to his crash chair. The pulse rifle was a good weapon. 40-shot charge pack, full auto and semi. 200-watt pulse, good weapon. Boxy and workmanlike, prone to mag dump, if not cautious.
But to the colonel, a weapon was a weapon. He'd killed with lots of them. In the end, everything was the same. Point and shoot. Don't miss. Be quick about it. Life and death depended on such basics.
And he would use anything he could get his hands on to kill every savage there was, even if he had to reduce the galaxy down to its Stone Age components.
Chapter 3. It could have been any four of the M-TAC crawlers that went up first, but it was the Alpha Company crawler that took the high-speed railgun round fired from within the city. It cooked off the fuel tanks, immolating 200-plus men in an instant, and all of this only 20 seconds after being down and clear of the Montague.
That was often said to be the official beginning of the Battle of New Vega, Alpha going up in an instant.
Or so the moment would be defined by the few who would survive to tell what had happened. The 25th was experienced, mostly a lot of brushfire stuff, violent, short, and brutal. They'd fought on Kimshana against guerrilla insurgents trying to take the colony for themselves, and they'd done their share of bug hunting on some outer worlds in the Spallurzan sphere. But they'd always had support superiority in the form of TAC air and artillery. Nothing had prepared them to see Alpha get smoked within seconds, nor to see the wounded Montague smoking from several different sections. Its engines were spooling down, and its lift repulsors were inactive. It didn't look like the crew was even making an effort to get off the LZ. And Marks was pretty sure that Goss was dead. He turned to the operations sergeant and the command team.
Tell them to get off the LZ. 3-6 needs to put down.
Enemy fire was coming at the four surviving crawlers as they moved toward different sections of the massive sports complex designated Objective Rio, the insertion LZ for Strike Force Warhammer. At its center was a stadium capable of seating 1 million spectators, watching up to 10 different games at once. This was the only place in New Vega large enough to be a landing zone while also providing cover to the vulnerable ships once they set down. The Porter was circling overhead and taking fire from both within the city and from the Savage Hulk beach near the Hilltop District. And even higher up, way above the stadium battle space, the TAC support carrier, Indomitable, was fighting her way down through the cloudscape. She was getting swarmed by those new interceptors, but she had PDC fire to spare.
The Rigelian escorts that should have accompanied her in would have been nice, though.
Drop the ramps and get the men off. Tell the crawlers to keep moving to secure the complex perimeter. Marks ordered. Fire and move into position. The savages don't get this stadium.
Someone aboard the Montague must have slaved the bridge to the emergency bridge, because the three huge engines spooled up into an urgent whine, and the massive repulsors on the underside thrummed to life. Slowly, amid the spray of grit and dust and incoming fire, the squat, snub-nosed assault frigate lifted off. It had just cleared the rim of the fantastic stadium when a missile hit it amidships. The pilot, or whoever was flying, added power. The engines glowed brighter as they struggled to push upward. But the damage was catastrophic. The ship pitched over and smashed into the residential neighborhoods beyond the stadium. Its reactor exploded, sending shockwaves throughout the area that leveled homes and buildings.
Big Bird down, someone called over the command net.
Colonel Marks disembarked from the crawler with headquarters company and followed the four-story gray-camoed MTAC toward a massive triumphal arch that had been the complex's featured centerpiece for the 100th anniversary of the Galaxy Games just 2 years earlier. Search and Rescue was trying to get a sit-rep and clogging up the command channel. Colonel Marks keyed in a command override, and his voice played over all other traffic.
Get off the net. They're all dead.
Whether that was true or not, now wasn't the time to send in search and rescue ships. The LZ was hot. There were no formal lines or influence or controlled sectors established, and there was effective anti-air in play. Sending in rescue ships would only get more people killed. Delta engaging the enemy, came a message over the command net. Marks and HQ Company reached the mouth of the arch at the stadium's western approach. First contact. Marks knew this was the most important moment in the battle, because they didn't know what they were facing yet, or how to fight it. He'd fought savages before, and every battle was different because every savage ship had evolved along different lines of technological development for close to 500 years. He stopped and scanned the dark sports complex. The only source of illumination was Alpha's burning crawler. After battering its way through a stadium exit away from the LZ, it had been met almost immediately with a direct hit from the railgun. At the north end of the complex, Delta's crawler was unloading with her secondary pulse turrets on tangos the colonel was trying to image with his Nox.
Whatever they were, they moved fast, like four-legged spiders.
But just as Marks thought that, he saw one stand up on two legs. The other legs were suddenly arms, firing some sort of rifle. Then it ran in a crouch off between a massive line of turnstiles that led into the stadium itself. More and more of them were swarming into the complex, all rushing for the stadium like a rabid throng of seamball hooligans. These savages could scamper over surfaces fast, as though they had some kind of innate climbing tech, which meant they'd have no difficulty quickly reaching the tops of the 100-plus-story super towers that were strung out across the once incredible jewel of New Vegas City.
These looked directly down into the stadium, and sniper or ranged fire assets positioned there could easily acquire targets covering within Objective Rio, like Alpha Crawler. From above, the Porter came in fast, flaring her repulsors hard, her reverse thrusters howling like a squadron of banshees.
The 3-6 Cav were also spillers in regular army units, and having some light armor and scouts moving in would help give a better picture of the battle in the hours to come, if they made it off the LZ. Behind Marks, the HQ crawler's turrets dumped copious amounts of pulse fire beyond the arch. The colonel turned and ran toward the MTAC's rear door. Now he would get a better look at what these particular savages had decided to become out there in the dark. Chapter 4. Headquarters company consisted of three infantry platoons assigned to protecting the staff officers of the 25th. All of them were shooters, as were the staff officers. Each had entered an officer candidate program only after serving at least one tour as enlisted and being recommended for promotion by their NCOs.
That was standard across the Spallersan military, which had merged old elements of the original Earth militaries with some of the old Martian units and brought them together to form an effective fighting force. As Marx moved forward, lead elements of headquarters were already engaged in a heavy firefight with forces beyond the arch. He tapped his comm.
Platoon leaders, tell your NCOs to watch the flanks, walls of the stadium, and then the seating. Be advised, enemy has the ability to rapidly climb over obstacles.
An anti-armor missile streaked past the crawler and sidewindered off into the night sky. At least the vehicle's ECM algorithms were having some luck scrambling incoming tracking. Marks linked up with SGM Andres.
I need the SGMs to move into counter-sniper mode, he told his senior-most NCO. Watch those three buildings.
He tagged three slender downtown super towers within weapons range of the stadium. All their windows were dark. Power was down across large sections of the city.
Roger, sir.
Then Andres was off to pull the squad-designated marksmen back and reorient them to this possible threat. A fusillade of actual gunfire, a thing Marx hadn't heard in years, resounded off the sides of the stadium and out across the cityscape. It sounded ominous and hollow in that way that only gunfire can. Some type of heavy weapon was moving forward and spitting death. The wounded were starting to be dragged to the rear. Each platoon had a designated medic, and a casualty collection point was set up at the rear of each MTAC. Marx got sit reps from Delta, Charlie, and Bravo, then moved forward to link up with the headquarters company commander, who was supervising an emplaced grenade launcher mech that hurled belt-fed micro-grenades all across the front of their line, buying time to get the rest of the company into protected firing positions. The company commander had his helmet's smart eye flipped down and was scanning the enemy on biometric IR. Marx threw himself down behind a pile of rubble that had been turned into a fighting position and pulled out his battle board. He linked into the CO's smart eye feed and studied the terrain beyond the stadium. It was a wide pavilion that opened up into a massive transportation station. Dead savages lay out there, their bodies illuminated by their fading body heat. Except, not exactly. Marx expanded the image and studied a specific corpse as ghostly rounds and lightning streaks of tracer fire zipped past their heads. The dead savage showed fading body heat in its head, fully covered by a helmet. The rest of its body was already well below body temperature, except in those spots where it had been hit by streaking pulse rifle blasts or impaled by hot shrapnel from the GLM. Interesting. The grenade launcher mech positioned forward of the crawler took an RPG round and exploded in a sudden shower of sparks. Thankfully, the ammo clamshell that fed grenades to the GLM didn't cook off and blow everyone nearby all to hell.
Sergeant Baz, shouted the CO, Captain Forrester. GLM's down. Send in the secondary.
No doubt the platoon sergeant had the platoon's assets at the rear along with the mounting casualties. Marks watched as a trooper took a hot smoking round right through the helmet and simply fell over. Ricochets and close fire zinged and streaked across the entrance to the arch.
Leave first platoon here, Marks ordered Forrester. Get second and third up on the stadium rim, right and left flank. The crawler will hold, along with first.
When the captain didn't reply, Marks looked over.
Steve, did you?
Captain Forrester was dead. A round had smashed right through his ablative chest armor. The plate was effective against the blaster and pulse fire most military units found themselves facing in modern warfare, and it was rated to withstand ballistic impacts from most projectile weapons, which meant the savages must be hurling some particularly fierce slugs into the lines. Marx took over.
Captain Forrester is KIA. This is the colonel. I'm taking command of headquarters. Second and third platoons, pull back and climb up to the stadium rim. Set up firing positions from there. Second on the left, third on the right. Signal when you're in position.
He got confirms from both platoon leaders before switching over to the platoon sergeant on the company net, who reported that headquarters had six KIAs and three wounded.
Medics ain't used to treating this many gunshot wounds, sir.
Marx ignored the comment. It didn't matter. Gunshots were what they would have to deal with.
Send me your reserves forward. Tell them to hug the tunnel and stay away from the crawler.
Wilco, sir.
The reserve GLM, a tiny little mech that deployed and spat out micro-grenades, was trundling forward when the surge came, when the savages stormed the arch. Mark steadied the pulse rifle behind a chunk of concrete and aimed at one of the approaching savages working its way up behind an abutment that guarded a wide set of stairs. Center mass with the micro-dot scope, and he squeezed the trigger. The first round nailed the thing in the leg and did nothing. Marks re-entered and fired again, this time nailing the thing in the upper chest. Still nothing. The hot round zipped through the thing's body, but it merely dragged away a spray of metal debris. Heat signatures in the head, he told himself. Tougher shot. Marks had always been a shooter. He let go of his breath and zeroed a shot right into the thing's helmeted face. Truth be told, the first two shots had slowed it, like some machine suddenly switching from turbo to cruise. But the last shot dropped it completely. At less than 80 meters, Mark saw the dark silhouette of brain matter and helmet fragments cross the night through his scope. More were coming. He turned his aim to a trio of savages getting close with what looked like a large recoilless rifle, some sort of anti-armor team, if he had to guess. The leader went down when Mark squeezed off 5 quick shots to see if enough body damage would do the trick just as well as a headshot. It did. Sparks and explosions erupted from the thing, and it shifted into its spider configuration and tried to scuttle under a dark advertising display. But Marks kept nailing the beast until it went down and didn't move. Tangos 2 and 3 crouched down behind the same abutment, out of sight. Now was the moment they'd be loading some type of rocket to take out the crawler, and at this range, the ECM might not have the time to do its job again. Marks dumped the pulse rifle's charge all into one shot. Then he waited, scope resting on their last known position. Half a minute later, as the savage gunfire reached a cacophonic level of chatter and the pulse rifle spat out staccato bursts of barking whines in reply, one of the savages in the recoilless rifle team surfaced like some ancient submarine. Just the head. Spotter, thought Marks. The guy turned his shapeless helmet back and forth across the line. The helmet was dull and mirror smooth all around, nothing to distinguish the front from the back. Marks watched through the medium-range engagement scope as the savage inclined his head to the left, like he was talking to someone, below the abutment. Some things never change, no matter how post-human you dream of becoming. Human communication is hardwired into the DNA. Mark shifted the scope to that position, to the spotter's left. Number 3 popped up with the recoilless launcher, boxy and hexagonal, resting on his shoulder, readying for a firing solution on an identified target. His shoulder, thought Mark in some distant part of his mind. Who knew? Could be a her. It was unimportant. They'd given all that up when they became savages. To Mark, they were things now. Animals. He pulled the trigger on the pulse rifle, preset to dump the whole charge, and vaped the shooter in a spray of blood, brain matter, and armor. The rest of 4th Platoon was coming up alongside to join first. Marks rolled over onto his back and yanked his battle board off his ablative chest plate. He filed an intel report with all leaders on target acquisition. Headshot is a kill. Use more rounds center mass to take them down. 3 at least. Send. He looked at the roster for headquarters company. Most of the officers had stuff to do right now, interfacing with Cav coming off the porter, redistributing supply, getting the intel drones up in the air. Captain Forrester was KIA, but the 1st platoon leader was still alive. Colonel Marks activated his comm. Lieutenant Milker? Ted Milker was on the far side of the arch, fighting from an alcove with a heavy pulse rifle team. Directing fire as the strange-limbed shadows, like spiders or octopuses, then, like men, running, shifted, and moved closer. Milker here, sir. Promoting you to captain. Headquarters is yours. Do not fall back. Can do, sir. Won't forget nothing. Which was the old motto of the Martian Light Infantry. Over the long years, it had found a home in far Spillerza. Chapter 5. With headquarters now under control and the first wave of savages fought off, nothing more than a probe, it seemed, the colonel set off to connect with the other four surviving companies and get their defenses linked up. Sergeant Major Andres accompanied him, as did a young PFC who served as the sergeant major's messenger. They found Charlie Company first. Charlie had fought off a counterattack on the flank in which the savages had tried to come through the stadium's lower levels. The flank attack had been easily driven off, but there had been some casualties. Still, they weren't hurt as badly as Delta. At the north end of the stadium, Delta had been hit hard. 50% of the company had been killed or wounded, and they were already low on charge packs for the pulse rifles. Bravo was the only company in great shape with almost no casualties. The sergeant major went with his aide and an ad hoc recovery team to check on the ruin of Alpha's crawler, and when he returned, the news was not good. 100% casualties, sir. No salvageable assets. On the field inside the stadium, the massive porter remained down. With anti-air in the area, it was deemed best not to take off until the Indomitable could get air cover up. Marks and the captain of the porter, along with Colonel Dipple of the 36th Cavalry, connected via comm with the Admiral aboard the Indomitable, which had finally been joined by her Rigellian escorts. They were on station at 9,000 feet east of the main metropolis, out to sea, and preparing to commence air operations within the next 30 minutes. "Less than an hour before daylight," muttered the sergeant major. "Be nice to have a look at the city before we go poking around for a fight." After the initial savage outbreak 6 weeks before, the city had gone dark. Little to no intelligence had been acquired since. "My job is to get out there and find civvies," said Colonel Dipple matter-of-factly. "My troops are ready to go, but I'd feel much better with drone recon in full daylight." "What about Angel?" Everyone looked to Marks. Though he was relatively unknown to them, he knew his introduction into the strike force at the last minute had caused a lot of speculation as to who he really was. He was used to that. He'd been told many times that there was something about him that seemed older, wiser, more knowledgeable. Did that, been there, stacked the bodies. Which, of course, he had. Angel was the next insertion wave of the strike force. A heavy assault carrier would make a low pass and drop the rest of the ground units across the city along designated lines. The idea was to link them up and form a cordon inside the metropolis to commence rescue and assessment operations while engaging the savages in combat. Rescue the civilians. Assess the degree of savage infection. Terminate the savage presence. Mark switched comm to the Pathfinder captain. He got the platoon sergeant instead.
"This is Bullfrog 2. Bullfrog Actual is KIA, sir."
"Bullfrog," said Marks. "Do you have the drop plot for Angel?"
"Negative on plot at this time, sir. We caught it hard with Delta when the savvies came through over there. Just me and one other left, and I'm hit. Sorry, sir."
Marks cut the comm.
"That'll be a bad insert, sir, if they got no jump markers," cautioned the sergeant major. "We got to make sure they come down around the stadium at a minimum, otherwise our lines won't hold."
Dipple strapped his helmet on.
"That's us, then. Recon in force. We'll go out 2 blocks from the stadium and drop markers."
That was when the next savage attack came against Delta. They hit hard and fast, again.
"We'll exit through headquarters," said Dipple as he ran to link up with his troop. "Be quick about it, Matthew. You have less than an hour to have those markers in place," warned Colonel Marks.
"Yes, sir," Dipple said, nodding. He continued on, almost sprinting to his objective.
"With enough men like that," Marks thought, "I could beat the damn savages all the way back to the ruins of Earth."
Chapter 6 36 Armored Cavalry Fast Attack. Attached to Coalition Strike Force Warhammer, New Vega. Staff Sergeant Michael Greenhill was riding in the third vehicle of the lead element of Colonel Dipple's recon when they passed through headquarters perimeter, squeezing by the big crawler guarding the tunnel. They passed the wounded at the casualty collection point, the dead laid out nearby and covered with their own ponchos. a thing no one had thought to use before the operation, as the weather report said no rain for the next 3 days. But the senior NCOs had known why you always brought your ponchos. Now a young sergeant like Greenhill knew why, too.
"Sucks to be them," said the driver. "Kurtz."
Greenhill said nothing from the TC position inside the Leopard ATAV. Above their heads, the gunner swiveled a heavy pulse gun from left to right and watched the streets to the sides. The lead two vehicles were covering forward.
Dawn was in the east, and not 30 minutes away when they made their first contact. Civilians.
They came out of the dark from one of the taller buildings, surging forward and waving, dirty and bedraggled, about what the troopers of the 3-6 had been told they would find. Some looked hopeful. Some were crying and dragging dead-eyed children forward as though they were running for their lives. From the lead vehicle, Colonel Dipple called a halt and directed the second vehicle, carrying the company commander, to move forward and cover the far end of the street. Greenhill's ATAV pulled up short of the surging crowd.
"Stay frosty, Burke," Greenhill reminded the gunner atop the Leopard.
Greenhill had fought on Kinshasa. He knew you could never trust crowds, and he knew what to look for. The true believer, with the thousand-yard stare mixed in with the desperate rest. The man on a mission. He watched closely as the colonel stepped from the vehicle, covered by his gunner, to interact with the crowd.
"He better just tell him to walk the hell on back to the stadium, 'cause we're on a mission, Sarge," said Kurtz.
Greenhill said nothing. He was still trying to find the man on a mission guy, studying the crowd and scanning faces. And then he saw him. Her. The him was a her. He saw, but he didn't see. Because when the voice, the whisper, tickled at the back of Greenhill's head, he didn't pay attention. Or rather, he had too much to pay attention to in that sudden moment of chaos. And this woman, this pregnant woman who looked like she was going to heave all over the place, she didn't qualify to the sergeant as a man on a mission. She detonated not 5 meters from the colonel. Who knows why? Greenhill should have keyed in on how fast she was approaching, practically throwing herself through the crowd, her face screaming while her body moved like some kind of marionette automaton. She went off like 20 sticks of dynamite and cratered the street. Everyone was killed. The colonel, his driver and gunner, all the civilians. The impact glass of Greenhill's ATAV spiderwebbed, but it didn't turn into a typhoon of flying fragments, and the vehicle didn't overturn. It jumped once and settled down. Glass blew out in the buildings here in what was probably some new Vega financial district. Greenhill's bell was rung. For a moment he sat there hearing nothing, nothing but a dull hiss in his ears that quickly turned into a whine.
"Whole thing is just gone, man," said Kurtz.
He was apparently referring to Colonel Dipple's vehicle. It was indeed gone. And the company commander's vehicle was being overrun by more of those black spider crawling and then running savages.
They came in so fast, the captain's gunner didn't even have a chance to fire before savages were hauling him and the captain out.
The captain fired his sidearm point blank. He missed at one savage's helmet. Two others tore him apart half a second later.
"Light 'em up," screamed Greenhill at Burke up top.
When Burke didn't fire, Greenhill turned to see nothing but Burke's boots and bloody legs leaning against the side of the turret. Greenhill moved fast, talking on the comm and crawling back into the gunner's hatch, never minding the blood and gore of what used to be Specialist Burke. He'd been through worse.
"All units, push forward. Ambush. Say again. Ambush. Follow my lead."
And it was true. Savages were firing from the buildings on both sides. The vehicle behind Greenhill's was frozen. No one was moving. Other vehicles were trying to get around it.
Greenhill opened up on the savages ahead. Firing a full burst of 20 heavy pulse shots at the savages, the armored spiders who sometimes walked like men, that were feasting on the bodies of the men from the lead vehicle, tearing out big chunks and holding their faceless helmets either beatifically skyward or down in some almost prayerful posture before some type of blender in their hands spun and eviscerated the flesh they'd torn free. The shots from the heavy blaster tore into the once humans. The heavy pulse cannons atop the ATAVs did significantly more damage than the lower-powered pulse rifles every infantryman carried, even to the armored bodies of the savages. Shots sizzled straight through their armor, leaving massive gaping holes. In some cases, they simply tore the upper torso right off the almost humanoid body. Greenhill turned and waved for the convoy to move forward.
"Follow the map to the next marker placement," he shouted at Kurtz.
There was a slight pause before Kurtz mashed the pedal and the Leopard jumped forward with an almost ethereal hum.
"We gotta fall back,"
yelled one of the other TCs at Greenhill over the comm.
"Colonel's dead. Mission is compromised, man."
As Greenhill worked the barrel across the street, firing into the savages and cutting them down, he ignored this and all the other horror-struck comm traffic.
"Negative," he barked harshly. "Stay on mission."
With Greenhill on lead, the convoy blasted its way through the ambush, leaving with more than 70% of its troops. They reached the next marker objective and deployed a beacon with less than 23 minutes to the next drop, designated as Angel.
"Hard left," yelled Greenhill over the whine of the Leopard's engine. "Pick up the intercept for the next marker, Big Park, down the street."
The dawn was rising in the east, and the morning air was hot and humid. And despite the forecast for no rain, to Greenhill, who could tell such things from all his years in long-range recon, it smelled like rain was coming. Beyond the park was the massive hill that topped New Vegas City, a place named the Hilltop District by the colonists who first landed here centuries ago. The base of the Leviathan Savage Starship, designated the Nest in operations briefings, lay just below Hilltop to its left. Yet it towered over the spectacular Hilltop super towers at the heights of that neighborhood. When 3-6 arrived at the large park sprawl, they found that it was on a slope, not entirely free of the Hilltop grade, something the map hadn't been clear about. Greenhill noted it for the marker's packet upload, hoping the loadmaster and the jumpmasters would take the time to interface and give a heads up to whoever was going to drop on this particular loke. There wasn't much time to do more. Not if all the OBJs were going to get tagged.
"Are you seeing that?" said a sergeant from one of the remaining vehicles.
Greenhill was busy inside his battleboard activating the marker, but he looked up. He saw the monster coming down toward them. Or that was what it looked like. Moving along one of the broad highways of the seven massive thoroughfares that led down the hill, crushing all manner of buildings as it went, was the largest mech Greenhill had ever seen. None of the Coalition worlds had ever produced anything even remotely close to being as big and ready to fight as the beast that was now coming his way. Even the Sanasians, the mechmasters, the ones who had pioneered mech technology, had never built anything that even came close to what the savages had fielded. The thing was easily 5 or 6 stories tall, and it moved on 4 massive articulating spider's legs. A central flat command disc rose up from its center, and from this jutted 2 wicked-looking heavy artillery pieces. And now that Greenhill was paying attention, he realized the ground was rumbling with each strike of its legs.
"No time," said Greenhill. "Moving on to the next marker drop. Spot reported to Fleet Intel. We got to keep moving before the..."
The sky overhead broke like sudden thunder. Greenhill had seen streams of such things happening before. Usually pro-military, oorah, patriotic stuff designed to scare the colony worlds into submission. But to be beneath it in real time, that was a whole other thing. The old United World's most iconic piece of military hardware was indeed something awe-inspiring to behold. Troopers within the column, parked in the shadows of the park at dawn's last blue, the sun rising red and violent in the east, watched as the massive supercarrier Highland G.W. Washington re-entered from jump right into the Atmo west of the city, streaking into the dawn on a descent profile.
Drop hangers and doors were opening all along her sides and belly.
When you absolutely must scare the living daylights out of the natives, send in the supercarrier.
Successive sonic booms caught up and cracked the skies wide open.
We can win this, shouted Kurtz as he dragged on a smoke.
And Greenhill, who wasn't necessarily a pessimist, more of a realist, wondered if indeed they could get out of this without having to go all Tyrus Rex on another world. After all, there were only so many worlds left.
Even that nightmare mech, the massive walking spider heading down into the fray, a definite game-changer, had to pause and watch as the incredible carrier, diamond-shaped from this angle, began dropping units all over the city. They were awe-inspiring, but they were early. The timetable wasn't perfect. Things would be messy, but it was still an incredible sight to behold. Heavy armor was dropped by screaming repulsor pods. Drone gliders landed the heavy artillery. Sticks of infantry and light vehicles came down by chute. Other units by fixed-wing cargo literally fell out the back of the supercarrier and then flew on their own. Strike fighters and bombers were shot from catapults off the top of the massive starship. Instant division on demand. The UW supercarrier was the workhorse and hero of old Earth, and she delivered in almost all of the great old battles, I-Day at Centaur, the Breach, the Red Pirate Wars back in the day. Within moments, the dawn sky was filled with an army dropped right at the savage's front door.
Yeah, said Greenhill to no one.
The blood from Burke's body was still as wet as the morning dew atop the ATAV.
We got a chance. Just gotta do this the right way.
Chapter 7 25th Spallurzen Light, North Arch, Objective Rio. Colonel Marks had sent the Sergeant Major to gather a reaction force to support the defense of Delta's position in case it was overrun. The quickly organized QRF would be staged near the Porter and ready to move as soon as possible. The colonel arrived on scene to find wounded infantry already being dragged back from the heavy fighting at the north gate. Two platoons had been significantly reduced, and the crawler had taken at least three hits from incoming anti-armor fire. Captain Moreau had been killed, leaving First Sergeant Watt in charge of the defense. The First Sergeant himself was bleeding from a shrapnel wound, and his arm was in a sling due to a compound fracture.
Watt, Mark said upon assessing the First Sergeant's injuries. Pull back. In your condition, it's best to organize the mess developing at the rear of the crawler.
I'm still good to go, sir, replied
the First Sergeant, and he kept fighting. Heavy-duty charge packs lay discarded all alongside the crawler, ejected during the death machine's blazing fury against the savages that constantly moved and fired in an attempt to take the gate.
We got this,
insisted Watt as the colonel stood and considered whether the man really should remain in the fight.
Our best LT is forward and holding.
Marks nodded at the wounded NCO and moved off at a crouch to link up with the LT. A sniper team, shooter and spotter, signaled the colonel as he moved forward.
Safest way forward, sir, is through the ticketing entrance inside the wall of the tunnel. Savvy's got snipers out there, and they're zeroed in on the arch tunnel itself.
Thanks, said the colonel.
He moved off into the darkness of ticketing booths that had been blasted open. A labyrinth of booths, barricades, and turnstiles girded both sides of the arch, providing cover from incoming fire. He checked his watch. 15 minutes until dawn. All his experiences with the savages told him that if they could hold until then, things might turn around. But the truth was, you never really knew when it came to the savages. Expect the unexpected wasn't just a saying, it was a rule, and the dead had paid to learn it. Inside the war and beyond the ticketing booths, Marks found the medics, the wounded, the dying, and the dead. Those still drawing breath were being pulled farther back inside the lines. The dead would remain. There was no time to remove them.
Where's Lieutenant Maydoun? Marks called out.
Lieutenant's that way,
shouted one of the infantrymen tasked to assist and guard the medics. Pulse fire and incoming hard ammo ricocheted in the tunnel arch and whined on high-pitched, almost hysterical notes. The colonel nodded and continued on. As he came up behind a heavy pulse gun team bleeding charge packs and rocking the enemy with a storm of blaster fire, he saw the problem with the battlefield at this end. This entrance to the stadium had been designed to accommodate traffic from the heavily populated northern portions of New Vegas City. What must have seemed like a good defensive position to the Delta CO had turned into a turkey shoot from the various apartment blocks and hotels that girded this end of the complex. He'd made matters worse by digging in too far forward, and as a result, had gotten murdered by ranged sniper fire. Maydoon, the LT now in charge, had pulled back to a series of security barriers that formed a choke point. But there was an ample kill zone between the support weapons to the rear and the forward infantry fighting out there in the security barriers. From the vantage of the support teams who were raining fire on a staging mass of Savage troops, it was clear that there was a larger Savage attack brewing from an underground tunnel opening, probably an exit from the city's subterranean transportation system. Mark set up next to a weapons team sergeant, settling into cover against the wall of an alcove as the heavy weapon let loose a histrionic blare that echoed throughout the stadium complex.
"We're running low on charge packs, sir. If they push the LT, we won't be able to sustain fire to keep them off," shouted the support weapons team leader.
The colonel peered out at the situation with his Nox. The weapons team sergeant was right. It would take no more than a 50-meter dash for the staging Savage mass to overrun from the left flank, and the infantry fighting from inside the security barrier would never see it coming.
"To make matters worse, I got no comm," said the sergeant as the nearby heavy pulse gun stopped roaring and a charge pack was swapped out amid much cursing from the team. "Come on, man," shouted the gunner like a kid whose fun had just stopped. "I'm lit to go."
Marks pulled his battleboard off his chest plate and tapped his way down through the comm channels to get a hold of Lieutenant Maydoon out in the security barriers.
"You want me to send a man out there to connect?"
asked the team leader, seeming impatient for the colonel to make some reply.
"He'll probably get killed trying, but..."
"Warmonger actual to Delta 4-1, said the colonel.
"Nothing."
"Warmonger to Delta 4-1, over."
Some static, a high-pitched whine. Perhaps someone saying, "Go for 4-1, crackled through, but it was hard to say. Marks debated what to do next. He could broadcast and hope they got the heads up that they were about to be overrun, but all he'd be doing for sure to improve the situation was hope.
"Give me all the cover you've got," he ordered the weapons sergeant.
"Roger that, sir." "Wait, what?"
Colonel Marks vaulted the smashed ticket window the emplacement was firing from and ran for all he was worth down to the security barriers. For a second, there was nothing but dead silence from the weapons team sergeant. Then the man screamed,
"Covering fire, you bastards!"
The entire firing line opened up as the colonel crossed into the kill zone. Sprinting as hard as he could through sniper fire to reach the security barriers where the lead element of Delta's infantry was holding out.
Chapter 8.
"Inbound," came the flash report over the command net. Concrete and glass exploded all around the colonel as he raced the last 10 meters and practically threw himself into the wall of the security barrier. He moved along the wall to a small overwatch building in the center of the stretch of barricade, most likely constructed to spot incoming terrorist attacks, and linked up with the remnants of the platoon fighting from within. The condition of the building reflected the condition of its occupants. It had been shot up in almost every place along its concrete walls, but like the platoon, it was still holding. The moment he entered, as men fired from the windows at tangos across the plaza, someone shouted, "Incoming RP!" The building shook as the micro-missile exploded against its outer wall. Across the plaza, Savage weapons teams opened up in earnest, and out there above it all, the colonel heard some ancient familiar sound, like an electronic game from long ago, signaling out over the Savage masses, a sound so old the young would never recognize it, and the colonel barely did, or rather didn't at all. Just some old fading to forgotten memory that shouldn't be here in this present madhouse.
That signal meant the savages were coming now. The rush was on.
Orient left flank, Mark shouted. Prepare to repel.
He had no idea if a unit trained under the Spallerzan military would understand that command, but the old Martian light would have. Maydoun started shouting out names and physically repositioning soldiers inside the bunker to meet the threat that wasn't even seen yet. Then hundreds of fast-moving armored savages, cartwheeling, running, and firing all at once, came up out of the tunnel entrance and rushed the security barriers. The colonel raised his pulse rifle, flipped to full auto, and started dumping fire into the swarming mass charging the left flank. The support teams from farther back were pouring in even more fire, and yet for all the firepower being expended, it wasn't enough. Within 20 seconds, the first shot-to-hell savages had reached the barrier. One of the Delta riflemen was dragged through a window and disappeared. A savage stuck his weapon through a wide opening and sprayed automatic gunfire that should have killed more than it did. A Spallerzan infantryman took a burst across the torso, screamed, and batted the savage's firing machine gun toward the ceiling, then, with his last breath, dumped his mag into the faceless enemy. And still more savages were coming. Badly thrown incendiary devices were tossed from the savage lines and managed to ignite some of their own in sudden streams of liquid lava. Yet, incredibly, the savages, with living fire crawling all over them, continued to shoot into the security barrier from just meters away. A voice over the comm, "Wizard to Warlord Actual." The colonel racked a new charge pack, held his rifle out the fractured window, and dumped the entire pack into the surging mass. Thunder ripped the sky above, and the colonel recognized the telltale atmospheric re-entry of a UW supercarrier entering the battle space. A soldier was handing grenades to the LT, who was popping them and tossing them into the savages. Explosions rocked the barrier, sending debris and fragments everywhere. One of the infantrymen sat down and began to scream in the middle of it all.
"Go for Warlord," said the colonel as he slapped in another charge pack, noting there were not a lot of charge packs left.
"Air support on demand," came the terse reply.
The colonel dropped his weapon and ordered an airstrike on his battle board, not directly on the security barrier bunker, but close enough to be a real problem. He marked it urgent. A second later, he got the confirm from the air boss running strikes with the newly entered interceptors and bombers that had come in with the supercarrier.
"Fast mover inbound, Warlord," said Wizard. "Special delivery in 20 seconds, which seemed to the colonel to be forever away.
A grenade came through the window, bounced off the far wall, and landed near an infantryman whose head had been blown off.
"Grenade!" shouted the platoon sergeant.
The colonel had just put his battleboard away and was reaching for his weapon. He was in no position to cover or to do anything to protect himself. He and a lot of other soldiers would take the blast full on. But Lieutenant Maydoun was already moving.
He grabbed the body of the dead, headless infantryman, and in one swift motion slammed it down on top of the tomahawk-shaped explosive.
Then he threw his own body on top of the other. The grenade went off. Body parts showered the defenders. Above all this, beyond the automatic gunfire of the savages, the scream of an inbound Valkyrie close air support strike bomber erupted across the sky. "Heads down on the ground," warned the dry voice of the pilot over comm, like it was just another day at work for the guy, and not the end of the galaxy for some. The colonel looked up and saw the four-tailed bomber with forward-swept wings lining up for her run. It came in steep and fast as the wings suddenly swept back, putting it in a slower flight configuration. Then the lethally famous AGM-98 pulse pod system opened up with her intuitive targeting, dumping 20,000 high-cycle pulse shots across the savages swarming the security bunker. Archival footage of the battle, studied from every angle,